Robin Hood Radio welcomes you to David Freeman's Science Insider with your host, the senior science editor of the Huffington Post, David Freeman.
Today was a really have a really special treat. It's very exciting to be here. I have as guest America's, I guess, best known and I dare say most beloved astrophysicist, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. Or actually, maybe I'm your guest. I'm in your office, your kind of inner sanctum here. So welcome, and thank you very much.
Hey, if I'm people's favorite astrophysicist, it's probably because I'm the only one they know. So I don't get big-headed about that.
Okay, well, it's such a treat to be here, and I know one of the things you want to talk about is COSMOS, the new program. This was a program that was, I guess it's kind of a redo of a program that aired in 1980, and it was a hugely popular program about space, astrophysics, science.
It's a continuation of the story.
So say, why redo it?
It's not redoing it. It's a continuation.
Okay. So what's different now? What's different in our world versus the world from 1980 scientifically?
Oh, yeah, almost everything is different. That was 34 years ago. And that original COSMOS was created during the Cold War. And there were scientific themes that informed what your thinking would or should be regarding nuclear arms at the time. COSMOS shaped its messaging based on issues, topics, phenomena that sort of mattered in the day.
Right.
And so we're 34 years later now. One of the great features of COSMOS is the extent and the depth to which it conveyed how and why science matters. So you don't think of it as a documentary where you tune in to learn with pages ripped from a textbook. You tune in to have Carl Sagan then, and I guess I now, to have he or I in your living room with you, guiding you through the sometimes torturous exercise of what it required to discover our place in the universe.
So, but scientifically speaking, if there were two or three new phenomena that were understood now, but what has astrophysics learned, kind of gotten under the belt in this past 34 years?
Well, tons of things, but that doesn't set the agenda for COSMOS, because it's not, the exercise of COSMOS is not, here's the latest discovery,
right,
let's tell you about it. That's what normal documentaries do, and do it quite well. Back then, there weren't many science documentaries, hardly any. Now, any time of day or night, if you channel surf long enough, you'll land on a science documentary on the search for light, black holes. We even have pop culture actors hosting documentaries, such as Morgan Freeman in
right.
Through the Wormhole.
Right.
So what a time of luxury this is for access to science. But that's not really what COSMOS is. So we could chat about discoveries over the past 34 years, but the discovery will matter to COSMOS only if the discovery matters to our understanding of our place.
Well,
let me ask you in the universe.
Let me ask you about a couple of discoveries, and maybe we can come back to this idea of our place in the universe. But for instance, there's been a tremendous amount of research on exoplanets.
Mm-hmm.
Are we any closer to, I don't know if you talk about this in COSMOS or not, are we any closer to finding extraterrestrial life, or is it still the same chance we had back then that we're going to stumble upon something?
Yeah, so that's a big question we all have. Are we alone in the universe? And exoplanets confirms the suspicion that planets are not rare in the universe. Life, as we know it, lives on a planet. So if we're going to continue to look for life as we know it, you want a good inventory of planets in orbit around other stars. Right now, that number's rising to 1,000
right.
or so. We certainly make mention of exoplanets. And there's a whole cottage industry of people trying to study the properties of the planets that have been discovered. It's very hard because they're orbiting next to hugely bright stars relative to their own
right.
Intensity. And this analogy is given, and you calculate it up, it turns out to be about right. It'd be like trying to detect a firefly around one of those Hollywood searchlights. pointing straight at you.
Right, not very easy.
It's not very easy. You need clever optical ways to block the light of the star and not have the light spillage interfere with... So, the whole industry just trying to understand whether those planets can support life, and if they do. So, sure. The questions have changed. It's not, are there planets out there? Is that's one way to ask a question 35 years ago.
Right.
Are there exoplanets? We know they're exoplanets. What are the properties of the exoplanets? Do those properties tell us that maybe they harbor life? The word for that, do they have biomarkers? Is there oxygen in their atmosphere? Is there methane in their atmosphere? These are the byproducts of an active biosphere.
What about some of the other kind of things that have come up recently? I think that the idea of multiverse has come along more. I don't know if it was active then, but now it's certainly discussed.
It was undreamt of then.
So are we in a multiverse or a universe? What's the thinking?
Evidence. We have excellent theoretical and philosophical reasons to think that we're in a multiverse.
Which means what? Can you understand it without physics, or do you need advanced mathematics and physics to understand?
You would need advanced physics and math to calculate what your multiverse is doing. But the existence of the multiverse, what we came to recognize was that quantum physics, which is the physics of the small, forces matter and space to behave in odd ways. We don't claim to understand it, but we can describe it.
Right.
This is quantum physics is the most successful understanding of the universe we've ever put forth. Everything that the tenets of quantum physics predicts for the universe, we go out and test it, it's there.
Hmm.
General relativity, which was put forth by Einstein, that's the theory of the large gravity and the large-scale structure of the universe, that also works. Yet, they don't work with one another. They don't talk to one another. Something has to give. If the universe is a coherent place, either one of these will subsume the other in ways that we have yet to determine, or there's a third theory not yet put forth that then encloses these two.
Is there a candidate for that now?
Well, string theory.
String theory,
yes.
Right.
So if you take the universe and go back to the Big Bang, well, the entire universe was small. So now you have a shotgun wedding, quantum physics and relativity. And in that shotgun wedding, if you follow through with all the predictions quantum physics give you, it allows multiple bubbles to form, one of which is our universe.
Right.
These would be fluctuations in this sort of quantum foam. And because quantum physics fluctuates all the time. But now the fluctuations are not just particles coming in and out of existence, which happens all the time. It's whole universes coming in and out of existence. And this is our theoretical, strongly argued theoretical point.
And it may be that...
And philosophically... The universe has never really made anything in ones. Well, Earth is special and everything else is different. No, we got seven other planets.
Right.
Sun! The sun is... No, the sun is one of these dots in the night sky. The galaxy! Milky Way. No, it's one of 100 billion galaxies.
Right.
Right. And the universe! Maybe it's one of countless other universes.
Yeah, maybe there's another multiverse. I don't know how that
works. Exactly. It might be that the multiverse is itself not alone.
Ah, well, you're going forever. Then you're going to touch on the backs of turtles all the way down.
Turtles all the way down.
So, what about, and I guess part of that is the idea that, as in quantum physics, we could, and you mentioned, we could blink out of existence. So our entire universe could...
Well, small particles do this.
But is it possible that the universe itself could blink out of existence?
It is statistically... so unlikely as you should just think of it as zero.
So don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it. Right.
So what about...
Because what happens is the way quantum physics works is the more macroscopic the system...
Right.
The less coherently it functions.
Right. becomes unpredictable at those scales.
Yeah, you can't. And no longer do the laws of quantum physics illuminating for you, and you're better off just using classical physics to describe the ball rolling down the hill,
right?
Not this collection of particles that might or might not come in and out of existence.
So what else? What other? I'm curious to know. You get in your position here at the museum, and in your speaking, I'm sure you get all kinds of questions, smart questions, not so smart questions. What are some of the misconceptions about space or astrophysics or the universe? Are you surprised that people have? If you could disabuse people of one common misconception, what would that be?
Professionally, I try not to disavow them of misconceptions. It's not my goal, because then you're running around putting Band-Aids on problems. As an educator, I try to get people to be fundamentally curious in their sort of soul of inquiry, and to question ideas that they might have or that are shared by others. In that state of mind, they have earned a kind of inoculation against the fuzzy thinking of these weird ideas that are floating around out there. So rather than correct a weird idea, I just rather empower them to know how to think in the first place. Then they can correct the weird idea themselves.
It's not
me running around saying no.
Well, not as a scold, but I'm sure if people ask you something, you might say, well, actually...
Yeah, but what I would do... No. No, I don't say no. I give them the argument so that they can understand why what they're thinking is wrong. I don't just tell them no. It's just not how I interact. Because then that's pontifical. It's, I know the answer because I'm educated and you're not. The answer is no.
Right.
And then they run away and say, oh, he said it's no, so therefore it's no.
Well, do you see yourself in a particular role in what some would call the culture wars over science, science deniers in the government? Is that something that troubles you?
I get people reach for me to have those fights, but I don't engage in them. You've never seen me debate anybody on anything, ever. I just don't have those conversations.
Well, I know, there's another popular science person, Bill Nye, is debating an evangelical about creationism.
We have people who do that.
Do you have a take on that?
We have people who do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't need to do it. Plus, I choose not to.
Mm-hmm. So you don't want to go there in terms of the evolution creationism argument, you know?
No, I just don't want to have a debate on it.
Because you think that's settled science.
No.
You don't want to look pontifical.
My investment of time as an educator, in my judgment, is best served teaching people how to think about the world around them. And then they can go off and do what they want.
So are you, let me ask you another question.
Teach them how to pose a question. How to judge whether one thing is true versus another. What laws of physics say about what a truth is in this world. That's an educational process.
Right.
It's not a debate and whoever argues best wins. No. No. I don't do that. I'm not saying other people shouldn't. I'm not saying it isn't a great thing that they're doing it. Bill Nye's going to do it. It's a hard road. But there are plenty of people. Richard Dawkins does it. Bill Nye is coming into that fold, and he's been debating climate deniers as well. You have Michael Shermer. You have Eugenie Scott. All these are very Googleable people, and you'll see the videos they're in sort of fighting the fight.
Right. How would you describe the reaction you get when you talk to groups of different types? Because people I know...
What do you mean by different types?
Well, I mean, you have different groups. You reach out to different groups. Students, younger people, older
people.
Oh, yeah,
different demographics.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, is there anything interesting about the different responses to different groups, or is it universally, I'm interested in science because they...
No. I study what the group is before I talk to them. And I go as far as I can to be with them while I'm communicating.
There does seem to be a huge...
So I will communicate differently to 20-somethings than I do to 60-somethings. If they're 60-somethings, I will reference historical events in the 20th century that they lived through that will give meaning and significance to whatever else I'm trying to communicate with them.
Well, that reminds me.
As an example. No, that's what that was my end part. So, as an example of what I do,
right.
I will do my homework on every demographic that I encounter.
Which reminds me of another thing I wanted to ask you, which is one of the things you might reference to an older audience is, you know, the early space program, maybe culminating with the moon landings.
Sure. It's not that I will reference it. It's that it's available to me in my toolkit of communication for that audience.
So let me ask you, if we weigh in on all the talk about Mars. There's Mars One. There are different mm-hmm. Initiatives, governmental, non-governmental, trying to get to Mars either as a flyby or to land and establish a colony.
With people, yes.
What do you want to have happen with Mars and with the Moon in terms of our exploration?
Yeah, I don't. Whatever else I look like on YouTube videos, I don't need to have anybody do anything. I don't tell people what to do. I don't tell people what to think. I don't start movements. I don't create agendas that people should follow. I don't tell people who to vote for. And as I said, I don't debate people. So, the way I'm going to answer your question is, if you care about the economic health of this nation, then you ought to know that innovations in science and technology in the 21st century will be the engines of tomorrow's economy. And the nations of the world that embrace this fact will lead the world economically. Just look at the growth industries since the Industrial Revolution and before. All right. We live in a democracy that is a capitalist economy. So I presume you care about your financial future. So what's the best way to get people interested? My read of this is, yeah, you can make programs that improve science teachers, but what do you do when you get out? Is it embraced by your culture? No, it's not. So that's a Band-Aid.
Right.
It has to be in the culture. The culture has to want to do it. And when the culture wants to do it, you don't need programs to make it happen. There were no programs in the 1960s to get people interested in science. There were programs to manage the rising science interest that became manifest when Sputnik was launched. But the interest was built into the culture. People were thinking about tomorrow in ways only science and technology could deliver it. The World's Fair is a product of the 60s. The World's Fair didn't create the 60s. This future speak, future vision. So, my read of human history and 20th century tells me that there is no force as powerful, as ambition stoking as exploring the great frontier. And right now that frontier is space. If you explore the frontier, and you know that science and technology will enable it, the press now has something to talk about every day. Oh, new discovery on the far side of the moon, on the back side of Venus, on this. These become discoveries. I'm in school and I read these discoveries. NASA needs someone to design an airfoil that will navigate the rarefied atmosphere of Mars. Who's with them? Sign me up. The culture drives the ambition. And when the culture drives the ambition, not everyone becomes a scientist. That would be a boring world. But people become science sensitized. Now you want to become a lawyer and you say, well, I want to manage mineral rights on asteroids. Because there's a mining company that's ready to go there. And all of a sudden everyone's thinking about a frontier and a future. And you have scientists and engineers among you who are inventing tomorrow and making secure the economy that is otherwise faltering. Because whole new industries are arising. The first trillionaire in this world is the person who mines asteroids. Mm. So, I'm offering the space program to you as a tidy way to stimulate interest in science and STEM careers, to switch your nation into an innovation culture, an innovation nation, and have that innovation become the fundamental centerpiece of tomorrow's economy. If you don't care about our economics, you'll come up with whatever solution you think is your solution, and I'm not going to stop you. Go ahead. So I'm not here to tell you to like space. I'm here to tell you the cost of not liking space.
Are you also concerned beyond the economic issue, concerned...
Oh, by the way, just to be clear, I would want people to go into space because it's just cool.
Yeah.
But I'm not so naive as to think that's sufficient to convince an entire Congress how to redirect spending.
Right.
Cool factor doesn't write checks. So in my aging maturity, I'm recognizing that people will vote pragmatically, not out of some dream state. So hence this economic argument for going into space.
Are you among the scientists who believes that humans have to become a multi-planet species? Is that also a concern of yours, or is...
I think it'd be great if we were on multiple planets, but I think it's unrealistic. And the arguments given, I find unconvincing.
Would you go to...
Look, I'll tell you why they're unconvincing.
Go ahead.
Hawking said we got to be on multiple planets.
Right.
You know, an asteroid could come and you'd still have some humans left if you're on two planets rather than on one. It's a nice idea, and it satisfies the multiple eggs and multiple baskets concept. How could you argue against that in principle? However, I claim that whatever power you have amassed to terraform Mars to make it look like Earth and then ship a billion people there, whatever effort that requires is more than figuring out how to deflect the asteroid. It's more than figuring out how to protect us from any possible virus that could take us over. It's more effort than fixing a runaway global warming Earth. You just terraformed the whole planet. You can't tell me you can't fix up Earth? You just turn Mars, which average temperature 200 degrees below zero with no water, into an oasis. And you're shipping a billion people there. You can't fix Earth? Something's wrong with you. So I'm not convinced that, yes, it would work as a solution to that problem. I just don't see it as a realistic path.
Right. So let me ask you another question.
I think it's a naive path.
But let me ask you another question, going back to the idea about Mars. If you were offered a one-way trip to Mars, and I'm going to ask you...
I'd ask what the point of one way. What's the point of it?
The point is to become a colonist on another planet. Is that held any...
No, but I don't see any point... of a one-way trip.
Let me
put it another way.
The return is less likely.
Let me say it another way. They're misunderstanding the concept of a one-way trip. The one-way trips in the era of the great explorers where colonies were being established.
Right.
Colonies were being established in places where explorers had already put the place on the map and was able to tell you, yeah, there's air to breathe, there's fruit on the trees, there's bring this winter coat, and here's a shovel and some hammers and nails, go at it. Oh, by the way, if it doesn't work out, come back. That's different from saying, here's a spaceship that is only designed to go one way. And by the way, when you get there, there's no air. And there's no water. You'll have to find it somewhere, and you have to ask us to ship it to you. This is not the same thing. So make it a round trip. You stay as long as you want. I don't understand the urge. I don't understand the point.
Right.
It's a mystery to me why that's some great, great advance in space exploration. I don't get it.
That's the end of the first part of this two-part interview with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Turn in next week the same time to hear the conclusion.
Science Insider with David Freeman, the senior science editor of the Huffington Post, produced in cooperation with Robin Hood Radio, robinhoodradio.com, on the web.